From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. How does an artist try to get back at a critic for a bad review? On today's Fresh Air, we present the Fresh Air Critics Panel, featuring TV critic David Bianculli, rock critic Ken Tucker, and book critic Maureen Corrigan. They'll recount some of their adventures dealing with art, junk, hype, and bruised egos. Also today, the suburban detective. We talk with John Katz about the hero of his novels, a private eye who's a family man with a station wagon, two kids, and the courage of a sissy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The first day of South African elections is underway. The Inkatha Freedom Party is reporting some problems with the delivery of stickers that add the party's name to the bottom of the ballot. The Independent Election Commission says two trucks of voting equipment were burned in one black township, but balloting has not been seriously affected. Many black South African voters are expressing hope and joy with their new political power.
We never dreamed that it will be one day the black to vote.
To me, it means really it's a surprise. I've never thought that the day will come like this one. I've been long waiting for the voting, and today it's here.
Bombs or no bombs, we are going forward with our votes. We want freedom.
The first voting results are not expected until today, or rather Friday. Fire officials in Japan say at least 259 people have died in the plane crash today in Nagoya. The plane was a Taiwanese jet carrying 272 people. It crashed and caught fire as it tried to land. China Airlines, which owns the plane, says the right wing touched the ground just before the crash. NPR's Marjorie Sun reports.
A China Airlines jet, which is based in Taiwan, crash-landed mid-evening at Nagoya Airport, which is about 160 miles west of Tokyo, and it exploded. The TV coverage tonight showed hundreds of rescue workers going through smoldering rubble, carrying body after body out on stretchers. The plane looked as though it had totally disintegrated. Didn't look like there was even a tail or an engine left.
Fire officials say 10 people have been taken to hospitals around Nagoya. Two people are still missing. Attorney General Janet Reno has testified before a Senate committee today about children at risk. She says she strongly supports keeping violent criminals behind bars, but she wants prevention programs enacted as well. She says that's the key.
Wherever I went, South Central, Los Angeles, Dallas, people were talking to me about how community policing had made them feel safer, how it had reduced crime. But more importantly, it also speaks to what you're here today for. It speaks to prevention. It was wonderful to see young people come up and say, "This guy's my mentor," pointing to the community police officer over his shoulder.
Attorney General Janet Reno. The Supreme Court has ruled the 1991 civil rights law is not retroactive. The law restores and expands workers' protection against employment bias. The justices have decided that it doesn't apply to thousands of cases that were pending when the law was enacted. The justices' vote was 8-1. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down almost 9 points at 3,696. The Nasdaq is up 3 at 733. This is NPR. Four congressional panels have taken up the Clinton administration's legislation to control pesticides. The bill is facing stiff opposition. The food industry and the American Farm Bureau Federation support a less restrictive measure, and they're backed by a majority of House members and 20 senators. The administration would get rid of the current pesticide rules. These consider the economic impact on farmers when deciding if a pesticide is used in the food supply. Instead, the White House bill would consider health guidelines only. Industry would be given new incentives to develop safer chemicals. Dr. Jack Kevorkian's trial continues today in Detroit. He's charged with breaking Michigan's law banning assisted suicide. Meanwhile, a special state panel has narrowly recommended to the legislature that the law be scrapped. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
The Kevorkian trial centers on the death last August of a 30-year-old man suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. At a news conference a day after the suicide, Kevorkian told reporters that he helped the man die. That admission is the centerpiece of the prosecution's case. But over the past day and a half, the defense has attempted to portray Kevorkian as a doctor who was merely trying to relieve pain and suffering. While the trial progresses, a state panel established to review the state's ban on assisted suicide remains deeply divided on the issue. Yesterday, in a close 9-7 vote, the commission did say assisted suicide should be allowed with strict controls. But political analysts say that recommendation is not strong enough to provide the legislature with any real guidance. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A private business research group says consumer confidence is at a 4-year high. The private conference board says its April index of consumer confidence jumped 5 points to 91.7. That's up 24 points from the same time 1 year ago. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air's critics help you keep up with the latest books, records, TV shows, and films. Today, instead of reviewing other people's work, they're going to talk about their own and share some of their adventures in the fascinating but sometimes risky world of pop culture criticism. Our discussion was recorded a couple of weeks ago at the annual Public Radio Conference in San Antonio, Texas. The audience was made up of program directors, station managers, and producers from public radio stations around the country. Let me tell you about our panelists. David Bianculli is Fresh Air's TV critic. He's written about TV for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the New York Post, and now the New York Daily News. He's also the author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He's the former rock critic for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner and the Philadelphia Inquirer. He now writes about pop culture for Entertainment Weekly. Maureen Corrigan is Fresh Air's book critic. She writes a mystery page for the Washington Post Book Review. Her reviews have also been published in the Village Voice and the New York Observer. She teaches at Georgetown University. I asked them first if they're ever punished for bad reviews, if publicists, advertisers, or the artists themselves ever try to get back at critics. Ken Tucker had this story.
When I was working for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, I wrote Billy Joel was in town for like a week, and this was my crowning moment in media publicity. I wrote a fair, reasonably scathing review of Billy Joel. And the next night, I'm told he brought it out onto the stage, brought the review out on the stage, put it on the piano, and before each song, he read what I had written about each particular song. And then at the end of the concert, he took the review, tore it up in little pieces, and said, "F*** you, Ken Tucker!" So I was living in Los Angeles, and then like that night I'm getting calls from the New York Post saying, "Well, we understand Billy Joel just said F- you." It's like, "Do you have a comment?" You know, it was like sort of nationwide news, coast to coast. Billy Joel abuses poor defenseless critic.
Well, did you have a comment to the press? Did you want to keep the feud going, or did you want to just cut it?
Yeah, I sort of wanted to keep it going for a little while, just to see how far it would go, but it didn't last very long.
Might I point out, although this is not a direct answer to your question, that our esteemed rock critic has just used the F word only 12 fewer times than Madonna.
Well, okay, for something that's
being recorded for broadcast.
Ken, what you just said, you could have not told this anecdote in exactly those words on Fresh Air. And in fact, when we broadcast this on Fresh Air, we will bleep out those words, as our radio listeners who have heard this tape already have heard. Could you have used those words in Entertainment Weekly or in any of the newspapers that you've written?
No.
How do you feel about that? Do you think that you should be able to?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I really think that the people reading reviews, I don't worry. I mean, I have three kids, and I'm not worried about kids coming upon these words in newspapers and having their lives destroyed, you know? I think on some level, it's just sort of one more tool that you can't use in terms of being precise and vivid and humorous about what you're doing, both on my end of it and on the artist's end of it.
Let's get back to punishment. David, have you ever been punished for...
only socially. No, I mean that seriously. I mean, like, I'm like this Bartleby the Scrivener guy, you know, who never leaves his basement except to record Fresh Air. I just write everything and send it out by computer. And it's like, "Would you like to come to this party?" "No, thank you. I would prefer not to." And I just stay there and write. But whenever I do show up in social situations, the immediate thing I have to, when I see somebody coming, Like, you know, the last party that I was at, and I'd never met her before, Katie Couric sort of, in a nice way, attacked me for when she interviewed Bette Midler and asked Bette Midler to teach her this particular mincing walk that she did. I wrote in the Daily News that it was closer to TNA than Q&A. And it was just a joke. But Katie wasn't particularly sold on the idea, or at least the execution of the humor. And so, I mean, so that sort of thing, I get phone calls a lot from people that I dump on, and you made too. And so that's, I mean, but that's part of the deal of doing business. So I don't mind that. But I've never had, I mean, nobody, I wish I could do something that would make people quit sending me TV shows, you know. But I haven't stumbled on that formula yet.
Maureen, ever punished?
Well, the same thing. I have people who track me down to my office and tell me that, quote unquote, I've ruined their life because I've given them a bad review. And it's never pleasant. I mean, it's not a fun encounter to have an author on the phone who's heartbroken over a review.
Now, do you feel like, well, I've really ruined this person's life, I've ruined their career, how can I ever give a bad review again? I'd better get out of this business. Who can stand hurting somebody's feelings like that?
I don't enjoy it. But I'm dealing with the work. I'm not dealing with the person.
You feel like you're trying to get at some kind of larger truth about how you respond to the book. And if a life is ruined, no.
If a life is, it's in the service of art, so who cares, right? Yeah. No. I mean, one thing that those phone calls remind me of is that there are real people behind the books, and that sometimes there is the temptation, especially when you're working on a deadline, and a great glib line comes into your head, that it would be very easy to use that line. But those awkward encounters sometimes remind me to put the brakes on that temptation. But in terms of making me a nicer reviewer, I don't think they do.
Have any of you ever been blurbed, you know, where you write a review and some of it is extracted for the ad to sell the book or the movie or the record? Dave, what are your blurbing adventures?
Yeah, I've got a very a perfect example of this, what I consider perfect. You guys can be the critics and decide. It was January 1st, I forget which year, but it was the year that CBS was presenting the Karen Carpenter story. This was, like, I think the day after their triumph with A Very Brady Christmas. So, I mean, two movies, two different years that were the worst of those particular years. But when I wrote my review, I came up with what I thought at the time was a fairly clever lead, starting out by saying that the Karen Carpenter story was the best telemovie of the year. And then I said, however, this is only because this is January 1st, and it is the first telemovie of the year, and no matter what movie comes next on what network, this will usurp it as the best movie of the year. And it would not surprise me if 364 days from now, the Karen Carpenter story wound up, as indeed it did, as the worst movie of the year. Well, I turn on TV that night, and there I am, best telemovie of the year. And I called them up the next morning, and they were roaring with laughter at CBS. They said, "You said it. Did you see the ellipsis? We left." So I learned that lesson.
Do you feel all pretty resistant to the hype machines in the fields that you cover? And has the hype machine changed at all since you started reviewing?
Well, certainly in music, it's now unfashionable to have hype.
It's like unfashionable?
In the sense that there are certain bands now, I mean, Pearl Jam refuses to put out music videos to promote its new album. They refused to, this last time around, to do interviews because they think this would damage their credibility. They would look like they're selling out if they were to actually promote the album that they worked so hard to do. So there's a kind of anti-hype machine that you sort of also get sort of filtered through. I mean, I think, you know, a critic just naturally resists that kind of thing. And I think that they, certainly record companies, I think publishers and to a certain extent TV networks know that they can't hype critics anymore, really. I mean, it's become such a cliche to sort of say this is really a great thing and you've got to listen to this. I mean, I think it's more kind of word of mouth, what you hear from colleagues, when you see people in clubs who seem extremely promising that you really want to hear their first release and that kind of thing. I think the hype is fairly easily resisted these days.
You've all written for different publications, plus worked on radio, and I'm wondering how you're edited differently at different places. Like, David, you've been at the Sun Sentinel
Gainesville Sun, Fort Lauderdale News, okay. And Sun Sentinel, Akron Beacon Journal, Philadelphia Inquirer, New York Post, New York Daily News, Baltimore Sun, Fort Worth Star Telegram.
Can't hold a job.
So, Ken, you've been in Entertainment Weekly, Philadelphia Inquirer, Herald Examiner. Maureen, you've written for the Village Voice, the Washington Post. I'm interested in hearing how different publications edit you differently in terms of what they want you to review, and the language they want you to use, the kind of stylistic concerns. David, do you have any stories about?
I may be unusual in this, and I have one column that runs right now, and it's syndication in the very narrowest sense of the word. I mean, I have one column, which is my primary job, that runs only in New York, but I have another column that runs not only in New York, but in Philadelphia at the Inquirer, in Fort Worth at the Star-Telegram, and in Baltimore at the Sun simultaneously. So I can look at and I send the same thing to all four papers to see what they will do. If this is a direct answer to your question, the Philadelphia Inquirer editors have 60% less of a sense of humor than the other newspapers. I mean,
they edit out your jokes?
Three out of every five. Just gone. And I'm shameless about this. I will write entire items simply to build to the joke. Like, I did this one real long thing about the Hunchback of Notre Dame and pointed out that there were seven other versions of this made, and this, out of all of them, this is the one where the director changed the ending of the original novel the most and changed the direction. And I did probably an hour and a half of background homework just to lead to the joke that the director's approach on this was obviously, Hugo, your way, and I'll go mine. In Philadelphia, that line got cut, and there was this dry treatise stuff about, and they're punishing me when they do that, and they know it. So that's...
Maureen, has it been very different getting edited at the Washington Post than at the Village Voice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But mostly in terms of language. It's odd sometimes to see the more colloquial language that I've used kind of be bumped up, upgraded for the Post. I mean, the oddest continuing experience I have of that, I also write for the New York Observer, and they have this habit of... If I'm referring to an author, say Carol Shields, whose Stone Diaries I just reviewed for Fresh Air, if I were to write that for The Observer, instead of just identifying the author by the last name, they'll identify her as Miss Shields. And it's like little stuff like that, for me, it doesn't sound like my voice anymore. It's too formal and, I don't know, it gets in the way.
Ken, when you're writing about pop music or television, I mean, I think those are the areas, more than any other area, where everybody has taste. I mean, their own taste, and everybody knows what they like, and they feel like, you know, I know what I like. I know about pop music, I know TV. So do you have editors who know pop music a little bit and know TV, and they think you're wrong?
Yeah.
Because they like that record that you didn't like, or
right.
They like that program that you didn't like, so shape
yes.
up, Ken.
Yeah, this is the curse of the baby boom generation coming to power and positions of authority. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I did this, the new Bonnie Raitt album for the New York Times, and the editor there was a big Bonnie Raitt fan and said, I really think we should quote some lyrics, because I think they're especially cogent on this album. I said, well, you know, I don't think the lyrics are that good. Well, but I think we should just squeeze in one or two, and there was this kind of sort of pressure that I hadn't had, you know, 3 weeks before when I did the Elvis Costello, and he just kind of shrugged and said, oh, nice review. And it went in as I wrote it. So you get that all the time. I mean, I will also bear out David's observation that the Philadelphia Inquirer is the most conservative and hidebound of the places that I've worked for. The first year that I was rock critic there, I spent the entire first year fighting with one of the managing editors who was in charge of the style of the newspaper to use the word kids, because they only used children or adolescent. And so it was hard to write rock reviews where you're saying, the adolescents were on their seats for AC/DC. And they really seemed to enjoy those young fellows immensely. And I finally got it so I could say the kids. The kids were really revved up for this concert. But that's the kind of little things all the time that you encounter.
We're featuring a panel with three Fresh Air critics recorded at the recent annual public radio conference. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with the Fresh Air Critics panel featuring rock critic Ken Tucker, book critic Maureen Corrigan, and TV critic David Bianculli.
Since you've each written for newspapers as well as magazines, and in a lot of those, in a lot of publications you've written for, there's news as well as arts, entertainment, culture. Do you think there's ever a double standard between the way the news is edited and the way arts and entertainment is edited? For example, what I'm thinking of is that in news, I think the understanding is, whether it's a popular story or not, if it's an important story, it's given the space that it deserves. But if it's arts and entertainment, if it's slightly more esoteric, they might not want you perhaps to write about it. Do you think that there's a different standard applied to arts and entertainment sometimes in publications than there is to hard news?
I think it's more a matter of tone. It's when you have hard news editors editing arts coverage, they're very much focused on the idea that writing should be objective, and my entire career is based on the idea that it should be subjective. And so there's that kind of basic, fundamental, philosophical disagreement that unless you have an arts editor who's really interested in the arts and who can separate him or herself from the kind of hard news objective training that he or she has had, you're really at loggerheads all the time about that kind of thing. And I think that certainly at the Philadelphia Inquirer, that was a big bone of contention that the paper is a superlative hard news organization. I think that its arts coverage is weak precisely because the arts coverage is edited from that kind of hard news perspective. When I was at the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, which is now long folded, a Hearst newspaper that was in desperate competition with the Los Angeles Times, which was not just the dominant paper in town, but the huge monster, overwhelming paper in town, we could write whatever we wanted, because if you made any kind of noise that was heard above Los Angeles Times din, you were doing your job. You were making an impact. And so we got away with murder. We got away with things that, you know, you would only get away with at the Village Voice. I wrote three pieces about a rock star that I made up I reviewed his albums. I just like tried to start a career for this guy. I had a mask on. I had pictures taken of me as the rock star. Nobody knew this thing. I just did this like three columns. And then,
did you reveal the stunt eventually?
No. For people who wrote in and asked where they could get this guy's records.
What was his name?
Glint Williams. I told them what the deal was, but I just, you know, figured I'd see who was reading and who wasn't.
Do you think that, the music book and record and film industries see critics and feature writers and us as broadcasters as a part of their public relations arm?
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. What are the manifestations of that?
I just think you try to be as independent as you can, but I think that everyone sort of leeches off everyone else. I mean, you're all sort of waiting around for a work to be produced, and then we all pounce on it and give our own individual pronouncements about whether it's worthwhile or not. And if it's a bad pronouncement, they ignore it. If it's a big pronouncement, they jump on it. It goes on, and you can go three or four. Hopefully, our motives for doing it are for an enthusiasm for the work, and their enthusiasm for doing it as artists is to make the work, and the publicist is to get more people to have enthusiasm and using us. But critics, by definition, would not exist were not there a work there in the first place.
Well, and in recent years in the features area, there's been so much more incursion of kind of press agent being able to control how a story is written that they can get writer approval in some cases, they can get photo approval, and so those. So that the publication will meet the terms to get the interview that they need. Seems to me that in magazines and newspapers, this is an area where you can assert your independence because the critic doesn't need to interview, doesn't need to cozy up to the star or the creator of the work, and that's where you prove your independence. Yet, I find that there is that kind of, I mean, even at Entertainment Weekly right now, it's not telling tales out of school to say that there are frequently occasions when they'll want to do a feature on someone and they'll say, we better make the arrangements for that really fast because Ken's got a review coming out that dumps on this show, so we'll never get that star to talk to us if he hasn't agreed to it before he sees this review. There's that kind of nervousness, which I find, you know, very disturbing.
Is this new, or has it always been that way?
I've noticed it increasing over the past few years. I think just especially in terms of, it just doesn't have so much to do with critics so much as the lowering of standards, I think, in the features area, that there are too many editors out across the country who have given in to this kind of high-pressure tactics that press agents and movie studios and TV studios have managed to impose on them.
Why do editors give in to that?
It's competition, exclusivity. It's, you know, if you do this, we'll do this for you. If you agree to have this writer who I know is not going to dump on my client, we'll give you this exclusive interview. And it's just that kind of competition is just increasingly so fierce with so many different kinds of magazines and newspapers going after the same small number of big stars that, the balance of power is shifting back and forth all the time.
I want to ask you a question that often comes up, I think, in public radio and certainly with Fresh Air, and that is dealing with subject matter with sexual content or gay and lesbian guests or something. Do you ever have to deal with subjects where you're writing about an artist who's really out there in their exploration of, like, gender issues or sex or sexual orientation or, you know, avant-garde music even or whatever, something that's considered outside of the mainstream where you have decisions you have to make about whether it's appropriate for your publication or if your editor, you know, does your editor think it's appropriate or what language you will use to describe this out, you know, this adventurous subject matter or whatever. Is that ever an issue for you?
I think most often it happens in terms of the, it becomes very frustrating in the language that you can use and how, like, you want to assume a certain level of knowledge on your readers' parts, mm-hmm. and yet the editors are saying, they'll never get this wacky person you're talking about. You have to start from square A and explain everything. And so you end up writing a far more literal-minded, right, square sort of piece than you ever intended doing about someone you admire and who you want to kind of communicate both to the person you're writing about and to the audience that knows about that person that you understand, that you get it. And yet you're kind of forced to write this, as I say, this kind of very literal-minded sort of prose. And eventually I think many writers just say, it's not worth the trouble, it's not mm-hmm. worth doing that. So you kind of stop yourself from doing it. In my case, there have been times when I would think, that's not a Philadelphia Inquirer piece, but I could do that for The Voice.
Right.
And so, you would literally do things for The Voice to let off steam, to write the way you want to do, because you have to write in the more formal way at a Philadelphia Inquirer, which, you know, has its own advantages in terms of reaching a much broader audience and a much more kind of mass audience that any kind of critic dealing in pop culture wants to reach. So there are kind of trade-offs back and forth.
The Fresh Air Critics Panel was recorded at the 1994 Public Radio Conference. We heard from rock critic Ken Tucker, TV critic David Bianculli, and book critic Maureen Corrigan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Suburban Mayhem. We talk with detective writer John Katz about his latest addition to the genre, a suburban private eye who's been described as a combination of Sam Spade and Mr. Mom. This private eye's office isn't on the mean streets, it's above a shopping mall. The tragedy he most often deals with is the tragedy of families that have broken up. Writer John Katz is also a media critic for New York Magazine and Morning Edition. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There are some problems slowing the voting in South Africa. There have been a report of shortage of ballots in black townships. This first day of balloting is for the elderly and disabled and anyone else with special needs. Officials say the difficulties should be solved by tomorrow. The BBC's Tom Carver reports from Katalhong Township near Johannesburg.
The elderly people have been waiting at this school since dawn for their chance to vote. The school caretaker told me that no one had told him a polling station was being set up here, and there appears to be a shortage of ballot papers. Meanwhile, the people sit patiently in row after row in the open sun, determined not to lose their chance. One old man said, "I've waited so long, I can wait a bit longer yet." The mood is remarkably good-natured in a township which has seen so much violence and bloodshed over the years. But if the voting is as slow on Wednesday and Thursday, when the polls open properly, it may well cause tensions to rise.
Tom Carver reporting. There are conflicting reports from Rwanda. One report says the ceasefire in the Rwandan capital has collapsed. Heavy mortar fire today reportedly ended a brief period of calm in Kigali. It's not clear if the shelling came from the army or the rebels. UN officials also say the two sides have waged a brief but heavy mortar and small arms fight in the city center. Israel has arrested 27 people, it says, were involved in a car bombing which killed five Israelis 2 weeks ago. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
The Israeli army says it and Shin Bet undercover agents arrested 27 suspects in raids on villages in the occupied West Bank. The suspects are said to be members of the extremist Palestinian group Hamas. The army says the leader of those arrested was also responsible for making the bomb carried onto a bus in the Israeli town of Hadera. The young Palestinian who had the bomb strapped to his body died in the explosion, along with five Israelis. News reports here focused on the announcement that two of those arrested are Israeli Arabs, not Palestinians. A disquieting thought for the authorities, who've taken several measures, including closing off the occupied territories, to try to keep Palestinians from carrying out attacks against Israelis. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Alleged CIA spy Aldrich Ames and his wife Rosario have tentatively agreed to a plea bargain. The Clinton administration says under the deal, both would admit their guilt and he would cooperate with prosecutors. The Ameses are accused of passing national secrets to Moscow for years. Stock prices closed mixed today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 6.25 points to end the day at 3,699.5. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR. A woman who shot a Kansas doctor who performs abortions has been sentenced to 11 years in prison. Rochelle Shannon was convicted last month of attempted murder in the attack on Dr. George Tiller. She was also convicted of aggravated assault for pointing a gun at a nurse's assistant. The judge in the case refused a prosecution request to double the amount of time that Rochelle should stay in prison. She maintains that she did nothing wrong. An international team of scientists says it may have found a basic building block of matter that scientists have been searching for years. NPR's Joe Palca reports.
For nearly 20 years, physicists at Fermilab, a giant atom smasher outside Chicago, have been searching for something called the top quark. Quarks appear to be the most fundamental particles in nature, more basic than the protons and neutrons that make up the nucleus of atoms. The prevailing theory of matter, called the Standard Model, says there should be a total of 6 quarks that come in 3 pairs. Physicists have found the up and down quark pair and the strange and charm quark pair. So when they found the bottom quark in 1977, the hunt was on for its pair, the top quark. Now Fermilab physicists say they think they found it. They haven't seen enough of the short-lived particle to be certain. Physicists expect it will take another 18 months of collecting data to be sure. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
The State Department says the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti has quit. Lawrence Pezzullo has decided to step down after meeting with Secretary of State Warren Christopher. His resignation takes effect on Friday. The White House says President Clinton has ruled out a tax increase to pay for welfare reform. Press Secretary Dee Dee Myers says the president told his welfare reform task force last night to disregard the suggested $3 billion gambling tax it had been considering. Myers is blaming the current budget situation for making a tax increase impossible. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. John Katz has moved the detective novel to the suburbs. His private eye, Kit DeLue, doesn't work on the mean streets. His office is over a shopping mall. The mysteries he deals with are the mysteries of family life. Why kids turn against their parents. Why parents stop loving each other. You may know John Katz from his media criticism for NPR's Morning Edition and Rolling Stone magazine. He recently became media critic for New York magazine. He used to be a network producer for Bill Moyers and the CBS Morning News. When he left his job, he started spending a lot of time in the suburbs, staying home with his two kids while his wife went back to work as a journalist. Katz's first detective novel was called Death by Station Wagon. The new one is The Family Stalker.
The Stalker comes out of the basic premise of the Suburban Detective Mystery series, which is that I find family life and gender changes in suburbia to be very dramatic. The question of families, relationships, and kids. And in The Family Stalker, Kit DeLue, the detective here, is confronted with a literal case of a person who is trying to destroy families, not by murdering them or stabbing or shooting them, but by insinuating herself into these relationships and destroying them from within. It's a person who has reasons for really hating families. And the notion here is that families are very, very fragile and easily off-put. And Kit finds his job here as to protect them.
There's a short reading I'd like you to do that I think gives away a little bit of the character of the suburban detective.
Well, in this section, Marianne Dow, who's an attorney who is also a wife and mother, comes to Kit for some help because she feels the stalker is after her family. And one of the names that comes up in this context is a person named Andrea Luca, who's a friend of hers. So Kit is talking, as he is about to investigate this case and has really gotten into it, Kit is talking about his feelings about taking on this case and what it says to families. I believe families, the traditional American foursome, the single parent and kids, the gay couple, or the survivalist commune, are sacred. I believe marriage and family constitute a contract that is horrible to violate, and one that should be abandoned only after every plausible attempt to save it, especially when children are involved. This perspective is shaped by my work, a great deal of which involves sorting through the wreckage of families once launched in optimism and good faith. My code on this subject remains simple-minded in a complex world of nuance and qualifiers. If you have problems, get as much help as you can find as quickly as you can. If you can't work it out, part company as amicably and compassionately as you are able. But to cheat, lie, or sneak around on a partner, I can't stomach that. In my work, I see the victims. My wife, Jane Leon, who is a psychiatric social worker, devotes much of her work to repairing the damage. Given my own non-Republican views on family values, Marianne Dow's story got to me. If Andrea Luca was, in fact, deliberately targeting the Dows for destruction, Marianne was making a plea from which it was hard to walk away. At the same time, I well understand the limitations of my profession. What can a detective do about a family stalker? 30 years ago, the hard-drinking private eye could have scared the hell out of somebody, even roughed up a suspect a bit. But I shopped, cooked, had two kids in the public schools, paid a mortgage and the bank loans on two Volvo station wagons. One well-drafted lawsuit would take care of my ability to pay for most of that. Not to mention what rough stuff would do to the image of a suburban detective. I have to stand next to neighborhood parents at soccer games.
John, what gave you the idea of creating a suburban detective?
Well, I was I had been working as an executive in television and suddenly found myself at home trying to take up a writing career. And several things were happening to me. I was noticing these incredible changes in suburban life. The suburbs were getting more diverse. There were two lesbian couples in my neighborhood. There were gay couples. And I saw more men around taking care of kids and at the supermarket. I also, as I went through bookstores, which I did a lot, I was struck by the fact that there weren't a lot of books about these sort of normal family life and what I perceive as very dramatic issues in family life. The large question of whether families survive, can they make it, whatever form the family takes, is to me one of the most suspenseful issues in anybody's life. And understandably, we're very preoccupied with violence, as we ought to be, and literal violence. But the damage done to families is really breathtaking. I could see it in the late 80s in terms of the economy. You could see it in terms of alcoholism or abuse. I saw families falling apart all the time. I remember one kid whose parents split up who had to give her pets away, and it was one of the worst things I've ever seen in my life. So I thought this would be great to write about. I also came to see the suburbs, which are sort of routinely dismissed by a lot of writers as boring, as this laboratory where all these social and gender changes and issues are really played out in the schools and the streets and lives there. So I wanted to try to craft a series that that took up this premise that this is suspenseful stuff. This is pretty white knuckle stuff, whether families can make it or not.
We know most private eyes are very urban and loners, even though a lot of the private eyes are getting surrogate families now. But your private eye is really the opposite of this. You know, he's suburban. He has a family that he's very much involved in and love with.
My private eye is strange. He's a real sissy. He doesn't know anything about fighting and is not good at it. He can't stand to be near guns. He is very different from the traditional private eye, who is, and even the modern version, these very good women writers, their characters are very unattached. You know, they don't have a lot of families. They don't have a lot of baggage. Kit Tulu in the Suburban Detective has got a lot of baggage. He has an old Volvo wagon. He has a dumb Labrador named Percentage. He has two kids. He has a wife who has had to go back to work and get a health plan to support them because he's out of work. And he has to juggle all of his detecting around these issues of investigating plus domestic care, getting his kids to lessons and taking care of their schoolwork. So it's a real juggling match for him. And along the way, he's able to learn about and see these pressures on women and changes in men's lives that I think make suburbia so interesting right now.
Why did you move to a suburb?
The usual reason. I had a small child, and we both wanted her to be sort of free to roam around. I wanted a one dumb dog, and I now have two dumb dogs. I just wanted some more space. But mostly, I think when I had a kid, it's a time when you start thinking about schools and how you're going to live and a little more relaxed way of living. And I'm glad I did, because it turned out to be much more interesting, than I thought it would be.
My guest is John Katz. His new suburban detective novel is called The Family Stalker. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with detective writer and media critic John Katz. Now, before you became a full-time writer, you used to work in network TV. You were
right.
A producer for Bill Moyers.
Right.
You were the producer of CBS Morning News. Why did you get out of network TV?
Well, in the late 80s, all the networks were taken over, and I left because I was pretty sure I was about to get fired. Like a lot of men, I did not make... Very hard for men to make choices voluntarily. Usually they're sort of bludgeoned or battered into doing it. I think I probably would not have left voluntarily if I was not certain I was going to get thrown out in this downsizing.
Now, what did you go through when you left? Did you try to find work at another network? Did you feel certain that you needed to have a job like that to both mentally and economically survive?
No, quite the opposite. I was determined never to work for an institution like that again.
Why?
I really wanted to write. I found the the corporate culture was frightening and very difficult. I didn't like what I was doing to people, and I didn't like what people were doing to me. I was determined that I not be detached from my daughter. I really wanted to know about her life, and I think the only way to do that is to be there a lot. You know, I wanted to know who her friends were. I wanted to know what her teachers were like. I wanted to know, you know, what clothes she wore and what went with what. I wanted to know how to treat her when she was sick. I didn't see any way I could do that if I was traipsing into the city every day. And I wanted to take a shot at writing about some of the stuff that I was experiencing and seeing, and because I didn't see a lot of it around.
When you say you didn't like what you were doing to other people and what they were doing to you, what were you doing to other people that you weren't comfortable with?
Well, I think the model of the network executive, like probably the publishing executive or the Wall Street executive, is brutal. It's very confrontational. You sometimes have to fire people, lay people off. There's a lot of politics, which I certainly participated in. It was a violent sort of life. It was frightening. It was draining. It was distracting. I was tense all the time, angry all the time. I just didn't want to live like that. And I thought in particular, I had an opportunity because my daughter was very young to have the kind of relationship with her that very few men have. And also I really wanted to try writing, which I thought would give me more control over my life. I mean, I felt like the only jerk I would have to work for was me. And not have to be involved in these sort of institutional politics, which I sort of swore not to return to and have been fortunate enough not to have to return to.
You are a media critic in addition to being a novelist. For years you wrote for Rolling Stone, and now you're media critic for New York Magazine. I'm wondering, now that you're a media critic, when you look back on the years that you worked in network television, do you see the programs that you did differently now than you did then?
I do. It's a very different perspective when you're sort of caught up in the middle of it and racing around from story to story. You almost can't step back and see it. And now as a critic, of course, I have to look at it differently. I see them as very different. I think one of the things I'm drawn to write about a lot is a sort of explosion of new media, online media in particular, as well as CD-ROMs. I think there's this explosion of new information. People are always running around yelling that there's the death of news, but I think news is being reborn all over the place in ways that are very democratizing.
Let me cite a couple of statistics that I'm quoting from one of your articles on the media. You write that a study commissioned by one network news division in 1992 found that the percentage of viewers between 18 and 34 watching commercial network news dropped more than 45% since 1980. That's amazing. And also that the percentage of people under 35 who said that they read a newspaper yesterday fell from 67% in 1965 to 30% in 1990. Now, the conventional way of looking at those statistics is to be absolutely mortified and say, young people must be pretty ignorant of what's happening in the world. They're abandoning news. They're not interested in the world. What's your interpretation of those statistics?
Well, I think this trashing of kids and kid culture is destructive and is wrong. I think, in fact, we're really having to redefine what literacy is and what a news story is, as well as how it's received. I think the traditional models of what we defined as serious news is definitely changing radically. But that doesn't mean that kids are ignorant or that they're not interested. It's just that they receive information in radically different ways. They might receive information from friends, from radio, from computers, from cable, from MTV, from going online. And for example, you know, Prodigy was the place where the news of the earthquake first broke. Kids receive information in fragmented, disjointed ways. They tend not to sit down and absorb whole papers or whole evening newscasts at once. And one reason is I think that kids' agenda is changing, you know, much more than the media is changing. I think we sort of grew up in this Cold War, Washington-driven agenda that isn't connected to young people now. And I think the answer is to rethink the agenda rather than to accuse them of being stupid for not consuming it.
What do you think the media is or should be doing to try to recapture the attention of younger audiences?
Well, there's several things that came up at kids, and I say kids advisedly. I mean, this is really people 40 and under. You know, we're not just talking about teenagers. They, for one thing, they're very busy. You know, they don't really have time to sit for 45 minutes or an hour and digest a traditional media in the traditional way. So I think they're going to be living in fragmented lives. For another, they have many more choices than we ever had. I mean, somebody who sits down with a television and a VCR and a computer has 150 options, where 20 years ago we had three options, you know, a newspaper and the networks, four options. So as long as there are these choices popping on, people are going to be splitting up. Kids like humor. They like organizations that don't take themselves as seriously as traditional media do. They like irony and satire. They like point of view, which the media is very wary of. They like fights. They like people to have real diversity of point of view. They are less interested in the sort of, you know, Cold War, Moscow, Washington agenda than they are in things that touch them more directly. They're very interested in gender. They're very interested in race. They're very interested in the environment and abortion. Issues like that that they see as touching them, they absorb tremendous amounts of information on. Issues that that older people are telling them are important and that are presented in sort of, you know, dull people in suits, they just click off of.
My guest is media critic and detective writer John Katz. His new suburban detective novel is called The Family Stalker. More with Katz in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Today is the momentous day that South Africans began voting in the first all-race elections. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what will we have from South Africa on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report on day one of the voting and also a profile today of F.W. de Klerk, the South African president who brought an end to apartheid and who will probably end up a deputy president when this election is all over and a new government is created. Also today, Mara Liasson reports on Bill Clinton and his administration's relationship with business. It got off very well with his support of NAFTA. Since then, hasn't been going so well. Also today, we'll be hearing about the boom in interest in living wills since the death of Richard Nixon.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with detective writer and media critic John Katz. Can I ask you, John Katz,
sure,
if as a media critic you ever feel like you're going backwards? You start by working on TV, the mass media of our time, and then you move to magazine writing and then to fiction, to novels. I mean, it's not exactly the way to go if you really want to keep up with the new information highway.
Well, I'm very sort of wired into it. I mean, I'm on a bunch of computer bulletin boards, and I follow CD-ROMs, and I write about it.
What do you talk about when you are online? And do you ever use being online as a way to plug your book?
Well, that's a great question. I'm on my base is The Well, which is a sort of San Francisco-based bulletin board, and I'm also sometimes on America Online. There's the men's conference I'm on The Well, which is where I can connect with other men. There's a sort of shorthand. You know, you can't spend too much time, at least I don't have that much time, to spend hours online. But when I click on in the morning for a half an hour, 45 minutes, we sort of keep up on one another's lives. My particular drama is my daughter is an adolescent now. And that's something I like to talk to people about that I was not prepared for, and had her first date. I talk about that. I found, you know, with men, it's quite interesting. Men talk online much more openly and freely than they do face-to-face. So I've made some terrific friends there. A group of us were helping another writer who has had a lot of money troubles, who was despairing about it. We help each other get published. If one of us gets an assignment and we can't take it, we'll pass it along to the others and see if anybody's interested. And, you know, I'll say my daughter had her first date, and I'll get 10 stories back about how they dealt with it or how they felt about it. If you're feeling, you know, depressed or discouraged or blocked even, you can go online and people, you know, writers will come on, or non-writers for that matter. And I have some good friends in Provincetown on The Well who will you know, who will just tell me to paint pictures of the dunes when I'm feeling, you know, like I'm in a particularly ugly period of New Jersey, this summer especially. So you feel like you can sort of be anywhere.
Your daughter recently went on her first date. Your daughter is becoming a teenager, or
right,
is a teenager.
Not yet.
Not almost.
Heading
okay
there.
And, you know, in your new novel, you describe how the father now isn't allowed to sit next to his daughter in movie theaters, and
right.
you know they're not supposed to act like they know each other in public. Did you feel betrayed when that started happening to you?
Well, I wouldn't say betrayed. It's a loss. My daughter and I are very close. You know, we've been through a lot together. This whole process of starting to write and what I write about is very connected to my helping to take care of her. And watching her grow up and watching her connected is absolutely the most meaningful thing I've done in my life. It's the most satisfying, it's the most challenging, and the most important work I feel I've done. And not to mention how connected it is to my writing, as you've pointed out. So I am well aware that this is coming. I mean, there's a point in adolescence where if you're close to your kid, they need to go. And they need to not want to be around you. And that of course, has come. And it's a loss, but it's very healthy. It's exactly what she should be doing, and it's exactly what she needs to not be made to feel guilty about doing. So I also celebrate it because I think on a very basic level, it means, you know, my wife and I did good work, and that she's comfortable, she trusts us, she comes back when she needs to come back, and touches base when she needs to touch base. But I think it's very important that she feel like, you know, she's free to go on her track, and I feel too. I have a lot of work to do, a lot of writing to do. So it's also time, you know, that we are less engaged with one another. One thing I did that was just, you know, tremendously helpful, that I think Kit does too in the book, is since she was about 18 months, we started this sort of junk food night, where one night a week, no matter what, she and I will go out and have junk food together. And I started doing this before she could even talk. And it was a great move because it was money in the bank in terms of communicating with her. We, no matter what else is going on in her life, when we sit down and start eating pizza, we talk. And so there's that closeness that I see is there and will certainly transcend adolescence or teenager or whatever comes. And I feel fortunate that I had the opportunity to do that and to be ready, because now that it's happened, without that, you know, I think it would be harder.
Well, John Katz, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you.
John Katz is the author of the new suburban detective novel, The Family Stalker. He's media critic for New York Magazine and NPR's Morning Edition. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our critics panel at the Public Radio Conference was produced by Art Ellis and recorded by Bill Deputy. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we broadcast our Fresh Air Critics Forum, recorded during the recent Public Radio Conference in San Antonio. Join us as TV critic David Bianculli, book critic Maureen Corrigan, and rock critic Ken Tucker tell us about their more memorable moments as critics, like the times people tried to get back at them for bad reviews. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.